This is All Sides with Anna Staver. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Anna today. It is our weekly Reporters Roundtable where we catch up on the political news of the past week and we preview the week ahead. It's going to be tough, and we begin this week with the attempted assassination of former President Donald Trump. A bullet from the would-be assassin's assault-style rifle grazed the former president's ear, but he escaped otherwise unharmed. Another man was killed, and two others were wounded before the gunman was killed. The attempted assassination has stunned the country, roiled the political campaign, and brought calls for a calmer tone.
I want to speak to you tonight about the need for us to lower the temperature in our politics. And to remember, while we may disagree, we are not enemies. We're neighbors, we're friends, co-workers, citizens, and most importantly, we're fellow Americans.
President Joe Biden last night speaking from the Oval Office. The shooting has prompted questions about security, the effects of hyper-partisan political rhetoric, and has us all wondering what will happen next. Associated Press government and politics correspondent Julie Carr Smyth was at Saturday's rally. She witnessed the shooting, the chaos after it, and has been covering the aftermath. She joins us now via Zoom from Pennsylvania. Julie, welcome to All Sides.
Yes, my old friend Mike Thompson, here I am,
yes.
In the middle of American history.
I tell you, we saw each other Friday night. You were on Columbus on the Record Friday. You were planning your trip, talking about how early to leave, what to bring. All of that planning changed in an instant. Where were you when the shooting happened? What did you hear? What did you see?
Well, I was in the press pen, which sits, it's a kind of a giant area, but it sits directly in front of the stage, but it's a very large area so that all the different media outlets can fit in there. And so I was, the speech had just begun, maybe, you know, we were not too many minutes into it. And normally I would be providing sort of commentary, and all of a sudden these shots rang out from the crowd. And, you know, we've just come through July 4th. You know, I think some people were confused. Well, was that a firecracker or a backfire or something? And then it became clear. It was just a rally of shots, which we now know were the shooter and the snipers who shot him. And then there was people didn't know what was going on. And suddenly it became apparent that the president, former president, had been shot. He ducked. The whole crowd went down. We're on a fairgrounds on the grass, and everybody's just ducking for cover, not knowing what's coming next, screams and that kind of thing. And then after he stood and raised his fist in that way, and people kind of started cheering, they realized he was going to be okay. And then they cleared the fairground in very short order. The police got everybody out of there. And then the media were even kicked out and told, this is an active crime scene. You got to get out of here.
So, I mean, what were you doing? Were you ducking for cover? How much of this were you able to witness and try to keep yourself safe?
I pretty much ducked down. My position within the press pen was not super close to the stage. Mm-hmm. And so I did two things. First, I rushed forward to see what was going on. And then as the shots were continuing, I went back to my table and I got under it because you just don't know what to do in that moment. You know, do your job or save your life.
Yeah, we're talking with Julie Carr Smyth, Associated Press correspondent for government and politics. She was at the rally in Western Pennsylvania on Saturday where former President Donald Trump was shot, grazed by the bullet, by the assassin's bullet. So after the shooting, you are ushered out. What was the atmosphere like? Were people panicked? Were they scared? Were they angry? The folks who were in the crowd?
People were initially, when they were on the floor, I think people were angry. There were a lot of questions. Is he dead? Has he been hit? What's going on? Because the people, the field was sort of divided into people who couldn't really see the stage, and some were watching him on the screen. And so they were on their phones or they were huddling with their loved ones and just asking a lot of questions. When they were asked to leave, there was absolutely no resistance whatsoever. However, In the midst of it, there was a section of the field where people had come to the aid of some people who had been shot or looked to be trying to help get these people to safety. I interviewed a couple of firefighters afterward who had been part of that, had been part of taking the injured people off of the grounds.
Where were those folks located when the shooting occurred? There was a retired former fire chief who died, a 50-year-old man from Pennsylvania, and also
Yeah, as
two
far
other
as I
folks.
understand it, right. They were in the bleachers to the left of the president, which would have been between sort of where the shooter was on this building, which was clearly visible from where I was. After the fact, I saw law enforcement walking up there, and they had at that point taken the body of the shooter down, but it was clearly visible there. So they would have been sitting in the line of fire, if you will.
Yeah. So you've covered these presidential events before, both presidential appearances, presidential candidate appearances, Secret Services everywhere. How would you assess the security as you headed in Saturday morning, afternoon when you arrived?
Well, I mean, I have two observations. One was the normal security, in that everybody had to go through scanners and have their bag looked at and whatever. As press, I was allowed to bring in more than most average people. Most people could not bring a chair or a purse or anything of that nature in there. And I was able to bring my bag and so forth. But then when I got to the press area, I couldn't figure out how to get in. These were these waist-high metal bars. And some people in the crowd just helped me climb the fence and get over there. And in the old days, or in what my experience had been, someone would have rushed over to me and been, "Who the hell are you? And where's your credential?" And nobody. There was nobody there. But there were law enforcement in a lot of places. They were all over the stage. They were at the perimeter. They were on the outside.
Now, when you cover these events, it's kind of disconcerting because you see these snipers surrounding where the president or the presidential candidate is going to speak. Did you note you, it's almost like you noticed that, but then you don't think of it after you've seen it a couple of times. You saw the snipers up there, I'm assuming, before the former
Right.
president was ready to speak.
Yes. As I was sort of surveying the stage, he comes out to sort of God bless America and everybody, or God bless the USA, and people are super excited. This particular day was I would call it much more lighthearted than, when I had covered him in 2016. There was an anger in the crowd that was, and a lot of it addressed to, toward journalists. But this day, people had picnic blankets, they're walking, couples holding hands, people bringing their kids. And it was a very pretty light atmosphere prior to this event.
Did you notice that building before? Hindsight's 2020, of course, but did you notice the building before the event started and say, "Hey,
I
let's have
mean,
it close"?
sure. And it was the thing was, there was this waist-high barrier, the one that I climbed, was quite a distance from it. And then there was an empty grass field. And then it was a kind of a tan-colored building. So I presumed that was just private property. It wasn't part of the fairground. And so it was off-site, if you will, which it turns out it was, but it was so close.
So after you've been here, you've been you're still in Pennsylvania, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
I'm still in Butler.
What has been the reaction since Saturday afternoon, Saturday evening, from folks you've talked to?
From what I can tell, it's a mixture. I've talked to people who say they're so sad. They're so sad for America. They're so sad over the divisions. I interviewed one neighbor of the shooter who said yesterday that he believes this is sort of the outgrowth of a politics in America that isn't, that people, average people, aren't feeling are representative, that nobody really likes either of these presidential candidates this year, and that raises this tension among the average people that, the electorate, that sort of they're not being heard and they're not being presented with candidates they want. And he was not an angry person, but he said he felt like America maybe needs another party. So there was sadness, there was speculation, and then, there was also has been anger. One of my colleagues experienced a lot of people driving by the fairgrounds yesterday, revving their engines at the press, shouting epithets and so forth. I mean, people who are wanting to be defiantly pro-Trump.
Yeah, what did you learn about Thomas Matthew Crooks, the 20-year-old man from Bethel Park, Pennsylvania, who has been identified as the shooter?
We don't know too much so far. What we have determined is he didn't have much of a social media presence. He was 20 years old. He went to a local high school where we visited yesterday. Some people have said that he was bullied, not really defining what that might mean. And so we're really still trying to figure this out. We do know that they were investigating whether there was a whether he also had explosives. And that's sort of an open question. And we know that the gun he used was registered to his father.
Yeah, and we don't know how he got that gun. I don't know what the law is in Pennsylvania. Can you have an assault style rifle if you're under 21? Do you know?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't
that
know
was a
that.
question. So much. There are so many questions that we're going to have to dig through over the next weeks and months. Even there's an independent review going on to look at the security and Secret Service and local law enforcement. We're speaking with Julie Carr Smythe from the Associated Press. She remains in Butler, Pennsylvania. She was at Saturday's rally here on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. So there was some question between local law enforcement and the Secret Service. Has there been some second guessing as to who possibly is to blame for what happened there?
Yes, I think that what we're trying to figure out today is, which law enforcers were assigned which areas. It could have been that local or county police entities were supposed to be on that secondary site. However, everything I've been able to discern is that regardless, that building was within the perimeter that should have been the responsibility of the U.S. Secret Service because it was too close to the president, the former president.
Yeah, just an incredible day. I mean, your thoughts. I mean, it really, you go to these events and you just think you're going to cover a normal rally and Trump's going to say some things that, are part of his political character, and then all hell breaks loose.
Right. I mean, we as reporters, these are fairly routine. He gives a stump speech that sounds a lot like it did the rally before that. And I guess for me, I've been wondering, is this the last political rally of that sort that we'll see? I mean, the fact that now, there's a possibility that Joe Biden may be at risk and, everybody on both sides seems to be tamping down the rhetoric and trying to call for just a nicer tone in this country. Well, that's to be seen whether that can even take place. But yeah, I mean, it felt like an escalation to some extent of what we've been seeing over the last 10 years.
Yeah, and for a reporter, having to change gears right away from covering a routine rally to a major historical event is going to be jarring, to say the least.
Yes, I mean, all of a sudden you're like, this is why I'm here, basically. I mean, Washington, D.C. can watch this on a live feed if they want. So I'm here to do this and, video of the crowd and interviews. And, I think that's the value of journalism is to be there to tell people what happened and to allow people to speak and talk about what they're experiencing.
The first draft of history happened on Saturday in Butler, Pennsylvania. Julie Carr Smythe, correspondent for politics and government for the Associated Press. Thanks very much for your time. I know you've been extremely busy and probably more than a little tired, but thanks for joining us here on All Sides.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
When we come back, we'll look at some of the reaction here in Ohio, lawmakers, officials to what happened over the weekend in Pennsylvania. That's when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
This is All Sides with Anna Staver. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Anna today. Of course, we are talking about The events of the weekend, the attempted assassination of former President Donald Trump in western Pennsylvania. He has arrived in Milwaukee for the Republican National Convention, which begins this afternoon. And he is expected to speak at the convention at some point today. That's the latest word from the campaign and from the RNC. This is our Reporters Roundtable, where we try to digest the week's news and look at what might lie ahead. Difficult these days. But joining me now is Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Sarah Donaldson. Sarah, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Ohio Capital Journal reporter Marty Schladen. Marty, welcome.
Thank you, Mike.
And Cleveland.com politics reporter Jeremy Pelzer.
Hi, good morning.
Let's run down some of the reaction here real quick, so bear with me. Governor Mike DeWine reacting to the shooting of President Trump over the weekend, former President Trump. DeWine says, quote, Fran and I are praying for President Trump, his family, and our country. Congresswoman Joyce Beatty, Democrat from suburban Columbus, writes in her statement, violence of any kind is unacceptable. We cannot allow it in our political discourse or our democracy. Her thoughts are with President Trump in a quick recovery. Sherrod Brown, Democrat, Senator from Ohio. Connie, his wife, and I are relieved that President Trump is safe and are praying for the health and safety of all those attending the rally. Political violence is completely unacceptable and has no place in our democracy, says Senator Brown. His opponent in the campaign this year, U.S. Senate candidate Bernie Moreno. Bridget, his wife, and I are also overwhelmingly thankful that President Trump is doing well and has never stopped fighting for the people of this country, no matter the personal sacrifice. He says, we need President Trump, an American legend, now more than ever. And the reaction that is getting probably the most raised eyebrows is from Senator J.D. Vance, Republican from Ohio, of course. He said today is not some isolated incident. The central premise of the Biden campaign is that President Donald Trump is an authoritarian fascist who must be stopped at all costs. The rhetoric led directly to President Trump's attempted assassination. Of course, we do not know the motive of the shooter in this case. Jeremy, that does sort of stand out, most of the other reactions. Now, his reaction came very quickly. I believe he was at the rally. Probably adrenaline was flowing pretty well there. But his stands out a bit, is a little hotter than others.
It stands out a bit, especially because the rhetoric that Senator Vance is talking about isn't just about politicians like and Democrats, but also the media, people reporting in the media, comparing Trump to Hitler, things like that. Bernie Moreno, the Republican U.S. Senate nominee, also in an interview over the weekend, mm-hmm. actually voiced similar sentiments. He actually called out a couple of media figures in Ohio for saying that, you know, for the rhetoric that they've used, saying that helped lead to the kind of culture of against Trump that led to Trump getting shot.
Yeah. Marty, we still don't know a whole lot. We don't know. This guy was 20 years old. He got a gun, apparently from his dad, the guy from Pennsylvania. It's undeniable that the rhetoric in this country since 2015, frankly, has escalated steadily.
It's been very hot. And when J.D. Vance makes that criticism, tries to blame Democrats, he's forgetting the rhetoric that Donald Trump himself has used. First of all, he tried to overturn an election that he lost. He called to terminate the Constitution. He said immigrants are poisoning the blood of this country. It seems to me that J.D. and there are other politicians doing this. They're basically saying no fair talking about this.
Sorry, but you can see how this happens. It's almost like a mob mentality. It starts off kind of low and just everybody sort of has to one-up each other. I mean, President Biden, apparently in a call to donors last week, said, quote, I have one job and that's to beat Donald Trump. I'm absolutely certain I'm the best person to be able to do that. So we're done talking about the debate. It's time to put Trump in a bullseye.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a right to a freedom of speech in this country, and I think political rhetoric oftentimes can kind of go right up to that line. I mean, you know, what it goes back to even January 6th. Yep. What is language that incites a coup attempt on the U.S. Capitol versus it's just political rhetoric. So I do think that you see that on both sides. You see that kind of talk on both sides about putting the candidate in a bullseye. Yep. Or, I mean, these almost violent sounding, but maybe the average person doesn't see it as violence. It's definitely a tough situation.
Yeah, I mean, it was probably, I'm sure he didn't advocate shooting the president, but basically let's zero in on criticizing the former president rather than talk about my dismal debate performance is what he probably, in all likelihood, said. But words matter. I mean, when Donald Trump on January 6th says we got to fight like hell, did he mean rhetorically fight like hell, or did he mean storm the Capitol, Jeremy?
Exactly. And especially as the nation has gotten more divided, you've seen these more martial terms, like a war on coal, for example.
And it's a war on everything.
A war on everything. You know? And so the rhetoric on from everyone has gotten more and more martial, like military-esque. And, you know, it's now like a battle. And even if it's not a direct call to actual violence, it's being portrayed in terms of it's us versus them and we need to fight, and inevitably you're going to then have words like bullseye. If you're talking about a battle, you're going to have talk that involves going to war and actually fighting the other side physically.
Yeah, Marty.
Yeah, in a country where we're having all these mass shootings, and we've had many instances in the past where politicians use these military metaphors, these shooting metaphors, put out mailers with, you know, opponents and gun sites. You'd think they'd learn by now that that's just out of bounds.
Yeah, I mean, now, Sarah, I guess the question is, the statements, these are all pretty much written statements. There haven't been a whole lot of interviews with lawmakers. That will happen this week, certainly with Republicans in Milwaukee. How long does this sort of calm, let's all be united phase last?
We were just talking about this before we came on. I mean, I think it will certainly paint the Republican National Convention this week. I think, although you're seeing folks like Senator J.D. Vance, he was a big example, using, you know, maybe a little bit more aggressive rhetoric. For the most part, you are hearing about unity. Even former President Donald Trump, his post on Truth Social was not inflammatory. It was very much a bullet grazed my ear, you know, I'm doing okay. It wasn't anything that was rise up and fight against whomever. And I think, again, what I keep going back to is, we don't know the motivations of this shooter. We do not know what brought him to the rooftop at the Butler Farm show. We just know very basic facts about him. And anyone on any side of the aisle trying to claim they know the motive doesn't.
Yeah,
right,
I mean,
now,
just go back to 1981 and John Hinckley. We didn't know why he did what he did until weeks later. And it turned out he was severely mentally ill and he was trying to impress Jodie Foster. I mean, we just don't know.
And so all we can do is speculate, and that's not necessarily all that worthwhile. One thing I would note is the shooter's 20 years old, and this is a common age for males particularly to present with, like, schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. And I did a little Google research last night, and you don't want to make the mentally ill objects of fear, but if you have schizophrenia, you have a higher chance of being suffering psychosis and being violent.
Yeah. So bottom line is, we just don't know. Jeremy?
Just in the short term, Sarah's talking about unity. The short term unity that we're going to see now is Republicans unifying behind Donald Trump. It was already happening anyway. But now you see, for example, Nikki Haley, his primary rival, literally, for the nomination, going to speak at the convention, going to the convention. And you're going to see that small minority of anti-Trump Republicans. You're going to see many of them now at least temper their criticism, and you're going to see a lot of coalescing behind the nominee.
Yeah, I don't think the folks who supported President Trump, they were behind him, regardless of this galvanizes them even more, but they can't vote twice. So they were going to vote for him anyway. What this does, I think, Sarah, is it certainly makes former President Trump more sympathetic. I mean, here's a guy who's came within an inch of losing his life.
I think so. And then he stood back up and raised his fist into the air. It's not like he cowered. I mean, that's the rhetoric I've seen on social media, even from left-leaning Democrats who said, I give him credit. He was under fire and he stood back up and threw his fist in the air. So it's certainly been, you know, it's an interesting situation to watch play out on live television. I mean, the national networks were carrying this rally live when this happened. And yeah. It was, you know, maybe in the corner box while you had talking heads talking on national television, but it was there. Yeah. So
Joe Biden has been on, was on TV three times in about 24 hours, Marty, after this happened. Short statements, no questions really from reporters, all pretty well handled. But he looked very presidential three separate times, and that talk of replacing him as the nominee has disappeared, at least for now.
It has, and we'll have to see how this all plays out, but time already is short, so this might buy Biden the time that he needs to, you know, be the only choice. I think the problem that they're all confronted with, though, is every time between now and November that he does something that reinforces the narrative that began with the debate, it's the news cycle is going to go right back to that.
This is our Reporters Roundtable here on All Sides. We're talking with Jeremy Pelzer from Cleveland.com, Marty Sladen from Ohio Capital Journal, and Sarah Donaldson from Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. We thought we were going to do this show today to talk about whether or not J.D. Vance was Donald Trump's running mate. Donald Trump is expected to speak at the convention sometime today. This is not previously planned. That's the report anyway. Do we think we'll know by the end of today, Jeremy, who his running mate will be?
From what I've seen, it's very possible. I've seen a report that he would announce the VP pick, his VP pick, in sort of an apprentice-style reveal tonight. We'll see if that happens. You know, obviously, a lot of things are in motion right now, to say the least. If you look at the tea leaves, there's been some signs from the RNC speakers that were announced last week that indicate that Vance might have a leg up in terms of Donald Trump Jr.'s slated to speak right before the VP pick. And Donald Trump Jr. has, of course, been a very big proponent of J.D. Vance, a close friend. And then if you look at, for example, the mayor of East Palestine is also scheduled to speak, and J.D. Vance was there early and often at East Palestine after that train derailment. But, yeah, I mean, they're keeping it very close to the chest, obviously, and so it's all speculation at this point.
I wonder how if the events of this weekend change the choice.
I wonder too, Mike. Will they calculate maybe that they don't want to step on the story as it currently exists? You know, that we're having this, you know, moment of unity, and obviously Biden, you know, continues to have his struggles. Why change that news cycle if you consider it to be favorable to you?
But we need a vice presidential nominee by Wednesday, so it has to happen because the convention has to nominate the running mate.
And it's certainly a short timeline, so yeah. It's do you draw it out for another 48 hours or do you, you know, make the decision today and turn it to maybe a more positive note? And it has been reported, it was reported over the weekend, and it's not, doesn't sound like it has to do necessarily with a potential VP pick, but immediately after the shooting, Ohio State Highway Patrol beefed up security for Senator J.D. Vance. Obviously, he's in the former president's orbit, whether he's picked as vice president or not.
Interesting.
But just should be noted that several outlets were reporting that over the weekend.
You know, Nikki Haley wasn't supposed to be there. She was talked about early. I don't know if she went through the vetting process or not, but she was. Then you have the equation of does Biden step aside, and is Kamala Harris the Democratic nominee? Is Gretchen Whitmer the Democratic nominee? And there's so many moving parts here. And then you throw in what happened this weekend. It's mind-boggling.
We live in interesting times. This is by far the most interesting presidential race, and not necessarily in a good way, since the 1960s.
1968 certainly had. That was, it's close to this.
And think about that. You're saying this 5 months out. We're months out from Election Day still.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to note that people are freaked out. I'm getting that from a lot of my acquaintances and friends. I think that the anxiety level out there right now is really high, and the shooting didn't do anything to help that.
Yeah, we're all just wondering what is next. I mean, we saw the debate performance we thought was going to be the crescendo moment of this campaign that would cause a major decision, a major shakeup, and then this happened.
If anything, this shows that people when something happens, especially big, like the, say, the debate performance, people are going to take from that, like, as if the election were today, like, oh, well, Biden's going to lose. Well, then something on the magnitude of, you know, the Republican presidential nominee getting shot happens, and it just makes you realize that there's a, as you're saying, there's 5 months left. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of campaign, and it's easy to say, well, if the election were held today, what would happen? But a lot can happen. I mean, just ask President John McCain what happened. He was all sitting ready to win in 2008, and then, of course, the economic collapse happened. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot that can happen. Even now, if it looks like things can go one way, there's a lot left.
So I wonder, Julie Carr Smyth, who we spoke to earlier in the show, who was at the rally in Pennsylvania, said she wonders if we'll have big rallies the rest of this campaign because of the security issues.
It's a fair question. And, you know, I actually grew up just south of Butler, Pennsylvania, uh-huh. So about 15 minutes away. My parents were at dinner. You know, they still live there. And it definitely shook up the local community. I mean, so many folks, it's a local story now. The shooter was from a school that my school played against. Mm-hmm. And it's when it shakes up a community like that, you wonder if other communities are going to want to host an event of that scale, particularly now local law enforcement is under scrutiny, if they maybe contributed to the failure of the alleged failure of the Secret Service.
Yeah. Marty.
Well, so what I understand is that it was a joint failure. The Secret Service delegated what they considered to be outside the perimeter to local law enforcement, and law enforcement left that roof unsecured. But at the end of the day, it's the Secret Service's job to protect the president. So I think there's sort of blame to go around.
Yeah, you can imagine who the Secret Service saying no more outdoor rallies. We can control something that happens in an arena like Nationwide Arena or this arena in Milwaukee or a high school gymnasium. You know, we've covered these rallies in downtown areas with thousands of windows overlooking where the president is speaking or where the candidate is speaking. It's, you know, it's amazing that it doesn't happen, frankly, more often, you know, in the time we live in.
True. I mean, you know, we live now in a society with more guns than people. A lot of these weapons are just out there and easy to get. And, you know, there are people who think it's a good idea to shoot somebody famous.
All right. We are talking with our reporters here. It's our weekly Reporters Roundtable. We're talking with Sarah Donaldson from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Marty Schladen from Ohio Capital Journal, and Cleveland.com politics reporter Jeremy Pelzer. When we come back, we'll take a step back and look at Ohio politics. There is news here in Ohio, some political news. That's when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
This is All Sides with Anna Staver. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Anna today. It is our Reporters Roundtable. We are talking about, of course, the events of the weekend, the attempted assassination of former President Donald Trump, and what that will mean for us as a country, frankly, going forward, and also looking at other political stories as well. We mentioned that J.D. Vance is among the finalists, we're calling him, for vice president. We might know today if he is the pick of former President Trump to be his running mate. Politics, the show must go on. I think the former president said that this weekend, Marty. What would J.D. Vance bring to the ticket? He's young. He's like 40 years old. He'd be the third youngest vice president to serve if he were to make it all the way.
And youth obviously is a commodity that is in short supply at the top of the ticket right now. I understand that J.D. one of the strengths that Trump believes JD brings to the table is he's a good debater. He's got this interesting story that he detailed in Hillbilly Elegy. And he's been, you know, after in 2016 harshly criticizing Trump, he is now as big an acolyte as one can think of.
Yeah, I mean, Sarah, J.D. Vance criticized the Democrats for calling Trump a fascist, but J.D. Vance called Trump a fascist back in 2015, I believe, saying he was America's Hitler.
Sure. I mean, when you if you read Hillbilly Elegy, I don't think his words in his memoir read the same as his words these days. It kind of paints as almost two different people in my eyes. He was not a Trump person in 2016. And, you know, it's interesting because when you're talking about his strengths, on the opposite side, in his he's only been on the national political scene officially for about 18 months. He's young, but he doesn't have necessarily all this senatorial experience. And if you go back to the election in 2022, he underperformed compared to Governor Mike DeWine. And of course, you're talking about a popular incumbent governor versus a newcomer. But he significantly underperformed compared to Governor DeWine. So it's that side of it is interesting to talk about in this debate.
There are a couple of reasons that presidents pick running mates. One is because they want to lure in voters from either a particular demographic, geographic part of the country. And then the other side is they want someone who will basically carry on their legacy to be their successor or someone who can be, you know, simpatico and work well together as a team. J.D. Vance obviously would be that second because Trump's very likely going to win Ohio regardless. And you have then Marco Rubio, who's been another person talked about, who would kind of fit more of the first bill, you know, from Florida, which is increasingly Republican. But I think especially after the last month or so of events that Trump would increasingly look at someone who is more likely to be a successor, especially if the polls show that Biden's support is crumbling, that you have someone who's more of a successor, then you need to shore up your base by picking someone.
Sorry, you're from Western Pennsylvania. Do voters there say J.D. Vance? He's a guy from our roots. He's from Appalachia. He's from Ohio. He's next. Does that help? Because Pennsylvania is very much in doubt. Michigan's very much in doubt. J.D. Vance brings a little bit of Rust Belt cred.
Absolutely. And I think the part of Western Pennsylvania I'm from is very traditionally Appalachian. Pittsburgh is the largest city in Appalachia and I think shares much more cultural roots with West Virginia than maybe central Ohio. But it's tough to say. I mean, I think, you know, the county I'm from is all for Trump. It went Butler County went, I think, the most for Trump in 2016 of any PA county. So I'm sure that anyone that Trump says is a good guy, they see is a good guy. But I haven't heard that much, you know, unique takes on Vance as a character so much. I mean, he's definitely been talked about in Ohio and he's got more of a national scale, but I'm not sure quite yet.
I joke, this is the end of the very important phase, which is the vice presidential speculation phase, which we go through every 4 years, sometimes on both sides. People don't vote for the vice presidential candidate, Marty. They vote for the president. Sometimes the vice presidential candidate can hurt you, Sarah Palin, for one.
You beat me to it.
Yeah,
I think that because the pick has something to say about the responsibility of the person making it. But, you know, and I think that the first goal is to do no harm. But then, like Jeremy says, draw in other coalitions, shore yourself up with groups of people, et cetera. But it's interesting this time around because Donald Trump is not a young man. I mean, on either side, whoever the VP pick is may very well end up being president.
Yeah. All right, let's turn away from presidential politics for a moment. Let's look at what's going to be on the Ohio ballot other than the presidential race and maybe what's not going to be on the Ohio ballot this fall. Voters will not get the chance to increase Ohio's minimum wage in this year's election. Supporters of an effort to raise the state's minimum wage to $15 an hour, they have come up short in their quest to get the proposed amendment on November's ballot. They collected more than the 414,000 signatures they needed, but possibly not enough to protect against invalid ones. And leaders of the effort worried they would not meet the requirement that they had collected a minimum number of signatures from half of Ohio's counties. Sarah Donaldson, you have covered this. You did a story last week looking at what went wrong with this campaign. What did go wrong with this campaign?
So leaders of the campaign have blamed it on a lack of support in rural areas. They said that they sent, non-white canvassers out into these areas, and they were met with racism and harassment and intimidation. I will say, on the flip side of that, I've talked to more than one person who was at least loosely involved in the campaign, was aware of the campaign, and one person I did talk to on the record, Evan Holt, he ran for Cincinnati City Council in 2021 and lost. He's a big organizer in that area. He said it was a very disorganized campaign. He said, I'm sure that they faced some racism in these rural counties. However,
they didn't present any evidence of that. They had one sheriff mentioned it, but they didn't have any video. They didn't have any firsthand accounts.
They've not been able to verify any of the claims that they've made to me up until this point. Mm-hmm. And Evan, said that when he was working for the campaign, he quit twice. Kind of joined back after someone else left. But I mean, just a revolving door of people in and out of the campaign. They couldn't really keep anyone. Sounds like they were really short on money, couldn't provide people with clipboards and T-shirts and campaign pins. They were out there gathering signatures for several months longer than the Citizens Not Politicians folks, and somehow still came up short. So it seemed like a combination of just real disorganization and mismanagement based on how Evan characterized it to me, and also just a lack of focus in rural counties. They were largely in the state's urban cores, and you can't make the ballot just in the urban cores.
No, you have to have 5% from 44 counties, which is hard to do. I mean, it's hard to get on the ballot in the state of Ohio. And Marty, this is why it takes a professional signature gathering firm generally to really improve your chances to get on the ballot.
It absolutely does, Mike. And I mean, this whole thing, as we learned in the House Bill 6 scandal, is a big racket. A whole lot of money can be spent just clearing companies that gather signatures from the field. They'll get paid not to work. And then you've got to get – and these aren't just 5% of anybody's signatures. These all have to be registered voters. Yeah. And you have to get half of them from half of the state's counties. It's a really high wall to climb.
Jeremy, they had a couple of elections to do this, though. Mm-hmm. And if you go to a polling place on election day, chances are you're going to find registered voters and get their signatures. And that's what really helped the redistricting amendment get on the ballot. So this really was just a poor effort on their campaign. Or lack of resources, if that's the reason why.
And I think Sarah laid out very well why that was. They said organizers said that they're going to try to go again and try to do this for maybe the 2025 ballot. So we'll see if that happens. It's interesting because I think going into the 2024 race, this was seen as something that would really help Democrats.
Yeah.
You would get the kind of voters that Democrats really need. You would get the union, white middle class, working class voters to come out and vote for a minimum wage hike. And it's surprising that this isn't going to happen now. And it's something that Democrats could really have used, especially Sherrod Brown is who I'm thinking of specifically. Yeah. And now is not going to get it.
So, Sarah, why didn't these groups jump in to help?
I did hear kind of on background that this minimum wage group, it's a national organization.
Yes, they kind of parachuted in.
Coming in. Yeah. And they did kind of shirk the idea of they didn't want an outside firm doing signature gatherers. All of it was volunteers or paid signature gatherers. If they're having money struggles, they can probably only pay so many people. It sounded like local organizers wanted to get involved and were not really able to. And again, I do kind of... when you're talking about folks who would vote for a minimum wage increase, I do question the claim that rural folks would be against that, because what I heard from Evan was the folks that he heard the most pushback from were, better to do suburbanites. That's how he described them, not folks in rural areas who maybe serve to benefit the most from a minimum wage increase, because in areas like Athens, Ohio, folks are probably still paying that minimum wage.
So by not submitting their signatures, Marty, this is the thinking anyway. I think Secretary of State Frank LaRose hasn't said this can happen automatically. But by not submitting their signatures to try to get on this year's ballot, they do have more time now to collect the signatures they need to get on that 25 ballot, as Jeremy mentioned. Is that the thinking?
Well, I have to say, I don't know. Yeah. I would have thought you had to gather them within a certain time period after you get your language approved.
So I actually checked with the Secretary of State and the Attorney General's office. Because it was certified petition summary language, even though there's some specific dates in there, both the AG's office and the Secretary of State's office tell me they're fine to keep gathering signatures. They can still use the signatures that they gathered. The risk becomes if they wait until the 2025 deadline, people move, people leave the state, people leave their county, and some of those signatures will be invalidated. But you're right in that because they waited to submit, they don't have to resubmit anything. They don't have to jump in through any new hoops because that language can be updated later on in the process. If they make the ballot, then they've got to submit the actual ballot language.
Yeah. And having further invalidations could be a big deal because something we learned in House Bill 6 is that for every two signatures you submit, roughly, one of them gets bounced.
Yeah, that's and they collected 600 some odd thousand, which is more than the 414, but generally you need double.
Yeah.
Unless you have a really good firm, like the redistricting amendment, they collected 730,000 or something like that.
Yeah.
So they're not double, but their confidence is high.
And early on, I mean, I saw one of the smaller counties, they had upwards of a 70% validation rate in one of the counties. And they were, the redistricting amendment, was they had folks validating signatures in kind of the same way the boards of elections will do. So they were pre-checking their signatures. You might see a higher validation rate from them because of that process that they went through.
So, Jeremy, that campaign, once it's official that they're on the ballot, which we expect to happen, that campaign, the redistricting campaign, which would set up a 15-member panel, if it gets on the ballot and if approved by voters, to change how we draw legislative districts, that will be a major campaign for this fall.
It will be a major campaign for this fall, and right now the expectation is it will pass. I don't know a lot of people who think it won't. The question then becomes whether that becomes an impetus for other races, for people to come out and vote for other races. Obviously, if this does pass, the biggest effect won't be this year. It'll be next year when they have to redraw legislative and congressional districts through the next census, and that's right now seems what we're on track to see.
I think it's a legitimate question also whether the people in power in the state house will follow what happens in November if it passes. We've already seen what happened when the Supreme Court ruled repeatedly that they needed to redraw those lines. They just basically ignored them.
Yeah. We'll this Maureen O'Connor leading it up, former Supreme Court Chief Justice, a Republican, now leading this effort, and it will be interesting to watch how this happens. You know, one thing we could really use during this time of strife and uncertainty and anxiety is marijuana for fun.
I knew exactly what you were leading into.
So it is legal in Ohio. There have been dozens of permit applications approved. The industry was saying we could be having recreational marijuana by mid-June. It is now officially mid-July. Sarah, where are we on having dispensaries sell it to everybody who's over 21?
I would venture to say there's been some disappointment among medical dispensaries who were kind of getting the impression from folks who were involved. Representative Jamie Callender, who has been involved in marijuana policy for years, saying, I'm being told it's a quick process. You're going to get your license pretty quickly after you apply. I mean, I had one dispensary owner tell me that he was placing bets with other dispensary owners on like what day one was going to be. And the Division of Cannabis Control was ahead of schedule. And now they're like, we've got till September. We told you we have until September to start issuing these licenses. So a lot of folks have kind of their, you've checked all the boxes, but you still have a couple more boxes to check license. That's how I describe it. And, you know, a lot of that is certain inspections that they have to go through, certain trainings that they have to go through to kind of finish this process. I don't want to venture to make a guess because I have not had anyone in the know tell me as to when this could actually happen. For a while, it was mid-June. A lot of them seem like they've got one more hurdle to clear, but I guess we'll have to wait and see because the Division of Cannabis Control is not saying anything more than we just have to get them out by September.
Yeah, you have to figure the folks who are going to be the retail establishments, they want to make sure that this goes fairly smoothly. There will be long lines. They don't want to be running out of product. They want to make sure that they're up and running when this gets going.
I would think so, but I also would think, for example, you know, I live in Milo Grogan, and a dispensary just popped up like a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And I have to speculate that they did that in anticipation of recreational being legal. So now they got all these sunk costs. So it's balancing yeah. smooth opening plus against getting revenue coming yeah. in the door.
That'll do it for our reporter roundtable. Lots to talk about today. My thanks to Marty Schladen from the Ohio Capital Journal, Jeremy Pelzer from Cleveland.com, and Sarah Donaldson from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. We are getting word that Donald Trump does expect to name his vice presidential running mate today at the Republican National Convention. So stay tuned for that here at 89.7 NPR News. And also stay tuned for coverage of the convention tonight starting at 9. And whatever else happens in this rapidly changing news world we are all living through. That'll do it for All Sides. I'm Mike Thompson on 89.7 NPR News.